You are about to listen to an episode of The Cypher before it was The Cypher. For our first 75 episodes, we were known as Outside the Lines with Rap Genius, and we had a slightly different format. In all honesty, our production value and sound quality today is much improved from these early episodes. That said, the content is so great that these shows are a valuable part of our archive. If you want more information about our transition, make sure to check out episode 76 with Ritz, which was our first one under the new name. To keep up to date on everything involving The Cypher, visit us online at thecyphershow.com or find us on iTunes. And now, without further ado, here's The Cypher before The Cypher. Welcome to Outside the Lines with Rap Genius, a weekly series that brings you exclusive, in-depth conversations with some of the most interesting and exciting figures in hip-hop. We're brought to you by RapGenius.com, your source on the internet for decoding, annotating, and analyzing rap lyrics. I'm your host, Same Old Sean. This week, we talk to George Alvarez, better known as Curious. The New York-based MC released his classic debut album, A Constipated Monkey, in 1994, following several years of singles and guest appearances with the likes of Third Base and Del the Funky Homo Sapien. Since that album, he continued to appear on record with friends like MF Doom and MF Grimm, but it was almost 15 years until he released a follow-up album, 2, which showcased a newfound maturity and artistry. We began our talk with the Puerto Rican and Cuban Curious by asking him how he felt he differed from the other major New York City Latino rappers around the time of his debut, Big Pun and Fat Joe. I wanted to start by talking about something specifically on the first record. You know, you talk about being Puerto Rican and Cuban, mm-hmm. a lot about being Latino. But unlike a lot of the other Puerto Rican rappers of that era, like Pun and Fat Joe and stuff, they were Bronx guys. Mm-hmm. And you were coming from the Upper West Side, right? Mm-hmm. What effect did coming from a different neighborhood have on like people's reception to you, on their expectations?
You know what? It probably did, but I wouldn't know what it was. Mm-hmm. You know, for one, being so young, and I was not, you know, even thinking about things along those lines. But I don't think it, maybe to some people it did, but overall, in terms of like the music, I mean, you just your music is a direct product kind of a where you're from in terms of your slang and you know stuff like that. But I don't think it was such a distinction, like because people would always, I'd read articles and they'd be like Curious George from East Harlem or Curious George from the Bronx, like they just write this stuff, and I'd be like, what? Like who? You know, like who right. took the liberty to just they tell you where you're from? Like no, you know, from 97 from Amsterdam. You know, but I've always I've been in Manhattan and the Bronx though a lot though. I've always been uptown and in the Bronx, and, mm-hmm. you know. But still, I mean, people just write whatever they want.
Yeah. Do you think like the Bronx guys? I mean, I know you know a lot of the Digging the Crates crew guys. Mm-hmm. Do you think that there is a sort of difference between a Manhattan and Bronx style? Or
let me think. Maybe a little bit. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I wouldn't say it's a Manhattan or Bronx style, but it's like DITC as a crew, they have their own style.
Right.
And then Terror Squad, they had their own style. But even though Fat Joe was part of DITC too, though.
Right.
You know what I mean? But I don't know. I wouldn't say there was such a strong distinction. Mm-hmm. You know, nah. It's too close, man. You know, going to the same club, dealing with the same stuff, you know, it's very similar.
So, just keeping on that track for a second, back in, you know, 94 or whatever, when that first record came out, there was a lot of stuff kind of like that at the time. And what I mean by that is that was a lot of that first album, Walk Like a Duck and that kind of stuff, is kind of playful, a little lighthearted, kind of fun.
Yeah.
And you get that on the first Brand Nubian record. Yeah. You get that on Runaway Slave. A little bit, you know. Uh-huh. And I guess I was just wondering, like, that sort of playful thing mm-hmm. disappeared after a couple of years from just about everyone.
Yeah.
And I was just wondering why you think that sort of sense of fun left New York City rap so quickly.
I think because the heavier side of life is so heavy and powerful mm-hmm. that it's like, you know, once we become immersed in that, everything else kind of falls to the side. I mean, like, not for me personally now, because I kind of like to have fun still all the time, you know. But I think within the rap game, you know, that was just more pressing issues and dealing with all that craziness. So I feel like that's all, you know, that's a more powerful topic. The other stuff is more fun, leisurely escape shit. Excuse me.
You can curse. It's fine. Okay, cool. Yeah. We got our explicit rating on iTunes. It's fine. You cool. can say whatever you want.
Yeah.
One thing that was kind of odd about that record was on Spelled Like a J, you say specifically that you're not doing beer commercials. You know, the thing about, like, might drink the brew, but won't do a commercial.
That's bullshit. I'll do the fucking commercial.
Dude, were you just saying that because people were doing St. Ives?
Yeah. I felt like, yep, you know what? That's funny because I haven't thought about that line or anything.
Yeah.
But at that moment, yeah, that's what it was. It was all exactly. I might drink the beer, but I won't do the commercial. Like, it just felt like such a blatant pump of, like, malt liquor, which I used to drink St. Ives. But it's just like, why aren't we getting to do the Coors Light and the Miller Light? Why does it have to be that shit? You know what I mean?
So, yeah.
Yeah, that's what that was.
Oh, wow. Nice. The thing about...
I drink a lot of St. Ives. but Colt 45 was more my shit. Than
yeah,
me, but
it is.
St. Ives, yeah, with the juice in it, mix it up and all that. Yeah, that was good.
I'll have to try that sometime. What juice would you use?
We used to put the Hawaiian Punch. Like, drink half of the St. Ives real quick and then pour the Hawaiian Punch. But then they came out with the St. Ives, like the blue and the red. And the, you know, yeah.
So that took
like
your idea. And, yeah.
Yeah, they basically, well, it wasn't my idea. It was the street. I don't even know if it was some New York shit, but yeah, they took someone's idea.
So your first hit single, obviously, was Walk Like a Duck.
Thank you for calling it a hit. I appreciate that.
What does it mean to walk like a duck exactly?
It means it's telling like people that are like full of shit.
Yeah,
it walk like a duck. Like you're a duck. Like walk like a duck. Like people made it funny. Like it was some kind of dance or something. But it's really telling people that, you know, are full of shit to step the fuck off and walk like a duck.
Yeah. Was it based on any particular criticism or person or group of people?
Just life experience. Just people you run into and continue to.
Mm-hmm.
You know, shit like that.
Yeah. And you talk about
Go ahead. No.
Yeah, when you talk about that period, you mentioned that you had friends, I think in the Spell Like a J, you talk about you had friends see your video, you know, they were seeing your video and stuff, but you were still broke.
Yeah.
And I think that must have been weird, right? Did that, like, put a strain on friendships? Did people not believe you?
No, you had to, like, had to keep reemphasizing that almost because all of us thought, yo, if your video's on the box every other day, you must be a millionaire. Like, they pay you $1 million every time they play your video. I'm like, yo, man, I'm broke. They're like, why he keep saying that? Because I got to let you know that. Don't think, because it's like this. Yo, I'm really pop. Like, you know, and then it's almost like a joke out of it, but it's not a joke. You know what I mean? But
yeah,
it's really like, yo, people used to really think, myself, of course, because I'm the one writing it.
Yeah.
First and foremost, like, yo, if you're on a video and they see you on TV, that means you're rich. Everybody on TV is just rich.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's nothing like that, you know, so that's kind of like where that came from.
Yeah, so I was talking to Quali about that, and that same thing is still true today. It's even worse with Twitter when fans from anywhere can reach out to you directly and be like, you're a rich rapper. You sold out the...
And you're like, yo, dude, I'm fucking paying child support. I'm trying to feed my kids. I'm paying more taxes. I'm messed up. Well, not me. I mean, but I'm talking about big rappers.
Yeah.
You know, they're like me. I'm messed up on a regular man's level.
Right.
I'm talking about like, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Even those rappers that are like, you know, they're still, you know, struggling. It's not easy.
Yeah.
It's not easy, man. I see what they're going through, you know, and, you know, it's no joke, man.
Yeah. So the your whole personality on that first record is kind of an odd one for a rapper, right? Yeah. You're confident, but you're humble. Mm-hmm. You're, you know, broke a lot. You say like, oh, I, you know, you again, very proud of what you do, but you say, oh, I never label myself as the best. I try to stay humble.
See, now I feel like I'm the best. I shouldn't have said that. No. Yeah. Like
so that. why rap from there as opposed to like most people, especially when they first come out, I'm the best, I have $1 million.
I think that's why I did it that way, because I always like find a way to go the opposite way. I think it's some kind of click, I don't know, a glitch in my persona.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? I kind of like to always go against the grain, you know? So nice. I think that's what I did with that. But also too, like, you know, I was really feeling like that. Like I was really being honest with this part of myself that was... You know, like the real human part, or that's what I was trying to do because I was still a dick. You know what I'm saying? But Yeah, you know, I was trying to, you know, trying to do it the right way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And by the time the second album came along, right, it's different than the first album. For one thing, your persona's a little more confident. You're sort of always up in VIP or whatever in a way that the character on the first
album. But you know how that happened? No, but that also happened because of who I was with at that time. And I just left the relationship with my son's mom, and I come back, and, you know, my boys are, you know, they, I wasn't going out. I was in the house all the time. My son was a baby. But then when I left that situation, now I'm dealing with my boys and my peoples. They got a lot of money. They buy things. They VIP it up. And I'm chilling, getting to taste that life. It's not me generating it. But I'm just there living it. So I'm documenting it as I go. Every time I'm making music, I'm talking about what I'm dealing with at the time. So that's what that is. But also, too, I was a grown man there. So I have a different type of confidence, you know, in that sense. But yeah, definitely, I was definitely doing different stuff during that period, and I'm not doing that now. So now I can make the next record and talk about how damn that VIP shit was fun. But now, you know, I'm like around the corner waiting to get in free. Well, I don't do that either. I'll just go home and watch Netflix.
Right.
You know, yeah. Basically,
nice. Netflix rap.
That's
my next shit. Netflix rap.
Our camera guy Dan comes up with the hashtag of the day.
If you can make that interesting and exciting, you're the shit.
Nice. You know? So that album though, it's also more outward looking than the first record.
What do you mean by
two? Is it's like more engaged with the world. It's like more hopeful, than the first album.
Good.
It's a little more serious in some ways, and like.
Good.
What do you think happened in the sort of long period between the first two albums to make that happen?
A lot happened, man. It's like,
I mean, you had your son, obviously.
Yeah, and also just, I mean, like, shortly after the first record, man, I just hit a point where it was like, you know, you just, I don't know, some people call it a, you know, religious people might say you've born again and you found God or Jesus, and somebody else might say you had a nervous breakdown. Somebody else might say, I don't know, you grew up. So, you know, it's just different word, but it was a transitional period, so... I mean, the fact that I hadn't done, like, I had guest appearances in between that time and songs here and there.
Right.
Very minimal, scarce. But the fact that I never came out with a full album effort in between that time, it's like, you know, you grow as a man. Some people wanted to hear the old Curious all the time. And it's like, you have to kind of wean the audience with your growth, but I kind of didn't.
Right.
So I kind of had to be like, okay, well... I'm a grown man here. I was 19 starting this record. Now, you know, I'm a grown man, and jump with me over here.
Is that why you let off with the intro where you specifically mentioned, like, oh, I have a family now?
You know what? You know me better than I know myself, man. And it's really a tribute to you, man, for really listening and remembering. I guess that's what Rap Genius is about, really. No bullshit. Because this is what was happening, and I wasn't even fully conscious of it until you're, like, putting it back in my face.
Yeah.
And yeah, very much so. Yeah, that would be the reason. This is stuff that goes on naturally through the creative process.
Sure.
You know what I mean? That you don't really have your finger on it, but when someone points it out, that's exactly what it was.
Yeah, definitely.
So basically, I'm asking people to jump with me from here to here. Some do. Some be like, fuck you. They don't. And some weren't really around you there. They kind of just caught on there. So you have all kind of different fans. But just as an artist... talking about that transitional period, it was such a long period of time.
Yeah.
And it's more of a man's perspective, a grown man perspective, because I still got some growing up to do, but I'm not going to say I'm all the way there yet.
Right.
But it was definitely a more mature, different outlook, and really very different, I must say, because I sit back and I go, whoa, it's a total different thing. I mean, the flow and the music love is the same. But in terms of the perspective and stuff, that's what time does.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. In Brand New Day on that record, you talk about, you know, teaching your son to be a man, about how no one was around to teach you. What does that mean to you, that phrase, teaching someone to be a man?
Oh, man. I mean, ultimately, you have to walk yourself. You know what I mean? A father, no male figure can do it for you. But they can sure as hell get you there faster to where you're getting up and walking.
Yeah.
So... I just noticed that you look at statistics and stuff, like over 80% of the jail population, if I'm not mistaken, didn't have a father figure present.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? I saw what me and my peers went through in our situations, being in school. I went to good schools, like Catholic-y, preppy schools growing up. And I look at like the minority kids that we were in those environments. The ones that didn't have fathers around, it seemed like none of them flourished in that environment. Then... you get You go back to your neighborhood, and in my neighborhood, nobody follows around. Out of like 50 kids that I hung out with growing up on my block, like maybe two of them, father was even remotely around. So then you start looking at what happens. The ones with big brothers that were active in their life did better. The ones that had nothing. So it was just, it just became clear as day to me. I knew as a child that I always wanted a father. I wanted that guidance, but instead I'd go and get it from older kids in the street and outside. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I could have almost went totally the wrong way.
Yeah.
Thank God, you know what I'm saying, I had a good family and a great mom. But a mom can't really raise a male, a son, because you're going to always go do shit that's out of control. And I feel bad for some of the stuff I put her through. You know, but I remember just wanting to, you know, following the wrong stuff and all that. And just having somebody in your corner as a father maybe can nip some of that away. We're going to find out now with my son, because nothing's guaranteed. They got people that had great parents, everything, and still fucked up and went crazy, you know. So nothing's guaranteed, man. But I feel like, you know, it is something important. And if you do have a child, man, male or female, you know, come on, man. Go handle your business. You know what I mean? Like, I'm not there every day. I don't live with my son, but I really make it a point to be a part of his life. And I just started. So talk to me again in 5 years and make sure I'm not full of shit. You know what I mean? Yeah.
Definitely. So you were talking about, you know, crazy stuff that kids do sometimes and whatever. And you have that one line about, like, oh, I've been around half bricks and shit since 86.
Yeah.
You know, and so on one hand, you're saying, you know, I was around that.
Yeah.
On the other hand, you're saying, you know what? I didn't rhyme about it. I chose to rhyme about other stuff. Yeah. Why didn't you rhyme about it?
You know why? Because I couldn't. Because my mom didn't raise me like that. I was around that. Mm-hmm. But my mom's ways and principles were just so far removed from anything like that. She tried to put me in good situations and all that. And all I did was go outside and had all that shit around me anyway, though.
Mm-hmm.
But she tried her best to, like, shield me from all of that shit. But you can't, because you try to raise your son, like, in the perfect, you know, in a good world. But look where you live. You know what I mean? And it wasn't like it's a horrible area, but it's, you know, rampant with drugs and rampant with stuff like that. So, you know. It was what it was, but, you know, but that also makes for a unique, I feel like it contributes to a well-roundedness in my persona, in the sense that, you know, I was around great things, and I've read a lot and you know, try to be articulate, and then also I've seen, you know, enough of the other.
Yeah.
You know,
one of the other things, a couple of the other things you saw turned out in this song, Rain Over Me, right?
Rain Over Me,
the Who sample. Mm-hmm. You have a verse there that talks about relatives and friends, you know, becoming victims of drug addiction.
Yes.
Yeah. So few rappers, like, obviously there's a lot of talk of the drug game in the rap world. So little of the music shows that side of it. So why was it important for you to talk about that side of things?
God, I think when I heard that track, I think ultimately the music gives me the words.
Yeah.
So when I... And that two album to me was, man, like, that album, like, even now I'm recording my newer album. This new record is kind of like a constipated monkey, because these songs right here that you just heard, they're not on my new album.
Right.
These are the one of them, the White Rum, is from the Benchmark compilation, and then the other one is on Diamonds compilation record.
Yeah.
But they're just two new ones that are leaked out now. But, like, my new album is kind of reminds me of Constipated Monkey, but 2012, like, it's a combination, because it's more of a party thing going on, and it's just like real, you know. But that during that two time, everything was so, I guess because I hadn't made an album in so long, like the thoughts were so true to life. Like I was really sharing. It was like a diary. That two record is like a personal record, and even the way the rhymes were written, there's a lot of space between them, and every line is concise, like very powerful lines. It's not wordy. It's not tricky.
Right.
It's just boom, boom, boom. I'm getting chills right now. It's just, and it's very close to my heart. Like, so these songs would just come on, and I guess I was just being as simple and close to the heart as possible with these real situations, and it was just coming out. It's almost like you're not even doing it. You're just letting it happen, and it's just coming out, and I'm looking back at it like, oh, shit, that was crazy. Like, you know, and now I'm in a different creative place.
Right.
So it's coming out different. You know, it's going to be a whole new adventure.
Yeah.
But that's the beauty of the whole musical journey as you keep doing it. But you look back at it and you go, wow, that place I was in and the way that, I'm not even going to say the way I did that, the way that came about was something else. But it's all powered by music. It's what, when you just love music and when you've become, when you've done your craft long enough that you could just absorb that music and just let it come out without interfering, with the least possible interference.
Yeah.
Like, the more I'm involved with it, the whacker it's going to be. The less, the more I move and just do it, the hotter it is. So that two record, very much like, very personal, man. I suggest people check that out.
Definitely. You know? There's a lot of really haunting stuff on there. Obviously, you know, is this the end? Especially, you know, really, like, really deep.
You listen, man.
So on, you were talking about music and letting the music guide you and stuff.
Yeah.
I know you're a big fan of the sort of 70s pop and soul. Yeah, like, you shout out Stevie Wonder and the Bee Gees and on that tune and stuff.
Disco shit and 80s. Yeah. I love it.
What other 70s like pop and soul did you love? And do you think like that kind of music had an influence on how you rap or the kind of beats you like?
Hell yeah.
Yeah.
That definitely got an influence on my flow. You know what I mean? There's something like disco-y funky about the way I flow my shit.
Mm-hmm.
It's never like real choppy and real chatty. Yeah. It's always moving. You know what I mean? Like, I like to let it move. I rather let it breathe. I don't, you know, so everybody's different. Some people's shit is like, back of the, and it's scientific, and I'm just like, all right, cool. But, you know, like, I try to never break the stream and let the air just keep flying through the whole thing. And that's like the disco with those strings going crazy and the, you know what I mean? Like, you just want it to keep turning around. So, like, when they'd be dancing, swinging the chick around to it, you know what I'm saying? like, you just want to go around. So I feel definitely. That flow, I just love that era, man. I love them, you know, Michael Jackson. The first record I had was Jackson 5 Christmas record. And my mom.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, so I used to play that on my little Fisher Price.
Mama's
Sick Kissing Santa Claus.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, there's some great songs on that record.
That was my first record that I had.
Oh, Santa Claus Coming to Town. The bass line on that is sick. Oh, man, yeah.
Okay,
Next time you re-listen, check it out.
I'm going to check it out.
Yeah.
So that was my first record. So, man, from there it just went. And I used to remember, man, like when I was young, I like go to my boy Eric's house down the hall or something. And his mother had all the like the hot R&B shit. Like, my mom, she just had Spanish music mostly. Right. She had me with that Michael Jackson Christmas record. She might have, you know, it's for kids. It's got a big bow on it, but that was it. It wasn't like I had a bunch of like Al Green shit or nothing like that. You know, it was Southside in my house and pretty much. Then hits like Gloria Gaynor, I Will Survive. That was like the single woman anthem. So every mother in my housing complex had that shit blaring. You know what I mean? Like, fuck, man, I Will Survive. You know, you got all these deadbeat dads and shit. So, you know, but I go to my boy Eric's house. His mother was really into this. And then my boy Baltazar, his mom was like really into this. She'd have all the records. So I remember the artist, man, or Stevie Wonder. Cover, let's say, like Hotter Than July, you know, I remember the drawing and he's on there with the braids and all that.
Yeah.
And then albums were like $5 and I get $5 from my mom or some shit one day and I walk to the record store and I'll be like 6 years old, 7 years old, and I go buy this album. And the dude will be like, who sent you to get this? You know, not believing, like, well, this little kid and little Spanish kid, white looking kid coming in here buying this. But it's because I love the music and I saw the picture.
Yeah.
So I knew exactly what it looked like. I go in there and buy it. They're like, all right, cool. So, you know, I just remember from young, that's what I loved. And, you know, all that shit, man, the Saturday Night Fever shit, the Bee Gees, you know, Michael Jackson. Then when, you know, Off the Wall came out and Michael Jackson by himself, you know, and then the Jackson shit prior to that, Destiny and all that.
Yeah.
I used to love those, all that shit, you know what I mean? And in the 80s, like Hall & Oates and... I love these groups. You know?
Yeah.
So all that 80s, the 70s disco to the 80s and all that pop, the hot shit though, Tears for Fears. I love that shit.
Nice.
We'll be right back with the rest of our talk with Curious. You're listening to Outside the Lines with Rap Genius. You can see Curious's verified Rap Genius account by going to rapgenius.com/curious. That's Curious with a K. Welcome back to Outside the Lines with Rap Genius. I'm your host, Same Old Sean. We began the second half of our conversation with Curious by asking him about his appearance on Third Base's 1991 hit Pop Goes the Weasel and its accompanying video, which featured hardcore icon Henry Rollins playing Vanilla Ice.
You had a brief cameo in both the song and the video of uh-huh. Pop Goes the Weasel.
Yeah.
Right? So, did you have any idea, like, the kind of impact that song might have? And also, like, what was Henry Rollins like when you met him? Did you have any idea
cool
who he was
shit.
At the time?
Nah, not really. No? They told me, but I had seen him on MTV, like, videos and shit. Cool as shit, man. I just remember being a cool dude, but I wasn't like, oh, shit, Henry Rollins. It was, like, parallel, like, when that's going on, and then I'm like, oh, shit, Henry Rollins, right. Like, this guy, okay. You know, and then, yo, then I was such a, like, on another planet that I remember one time meeting Tito Puente. And I didn't even know who he was. Like, I heard the name, but then when I saw the face, I was just like, yo, dude, you play good, man. You know what I'm saying? And he's looking at me like, you fucking jerk. Like, don't you know who I am? And I'm just like, yo, I'm just watching them at Supper Club performing. And I'm just like, yo, this shit is hot. You know, but I didn't know what he looked like.
Right.
And he comes by the bar, and I'm like, yo, man, you really good. Like, talking to him, he's like, who's this little asshole talking to me like this? It was awesome, though. He was looking at me, and then I was just like, yo, what the hell? So it was, like, probably the same kind of deal with Henry Rollins. Mm-hmm. I probably went up to him like, yo, what's up, man? You're pretty good, man. It's, you know, but,
right. Yeah, well, what was the scene that I remember, you know, third bass getting really popular around that record and a couple other hits around that point.
Yeah,
obviously,
big,
you knew Search pretty well.
I knew Search pretty well and Pete, but I mean, you know, I knew Bobito. Bobito knew them.
So right.
It was like through him. You know, I was always cool with them. And then I was under Pete's production company later on, which that didn't work out too well. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So
more time on baseball cards than.
Yeah, I guess more time on baseball cards and also like a lot of bad business, man. Like,
sure.
You know. Just fucked up.
Sure.
Yeah.
Another rapper, obviously, that we were talking about before that you've known for a while is the man formerly known as Zevlov X.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Did you have any idea, as Doom, obviously, as he's known now, did you have any idea when you knew him as Zevlov X, when you knew him in KMD or whatever, that he'd develop into such a really, like, distinctive voice?
I mean, I was there during that whole process when he became Doom and when he was doing Doom.
Right, because you were on the first
album,
Doom
yeah.
record, yeah.
So I was with him. But honestly, man, nah. When he was doing that shit and the mask and all that, I always knew he could rhyme and I just respected his artistry. But just more of him as a person, like the way we would just talk, just to, you know, philosophically and during those years where you're young and you're learning about the world. And we used to talk so much. He's just such a brilliant dude. And I always liked his music, but I didn't see that coming. Like, yeah. He had that vision in his mind, and he put it down, and it almost against, like, even, like, my ear, like, I never would discourage him, because I knew he was just dope, but, like, me, like, that lane that he went into was even foreign to me, because, you know, I grew up around, like, you know, it's like that real boom bap,
yeah.
You know, all that jazz with no drums, and all that real super weird stuff, like, you know what I mean, that wasn't my thing. Me and Doom could meet at a ground musically.
Yeah,
and we're brothers, humanly.
Yeah,
but in terms of that lane that he took, I couldn't see that. That was his vision. He told me one time though, he saw there was Mos Def was doing a show, like it was like at not B.B. King, or some shit like that. That's got the old theater canopy, but I don't know where it was. And there was like a line of kids around the corner. You know, it was like, mostly like white kids and Japanese kids. You know, that was really the main one at that time. Those were the kids that, Keith Doom said to me, you see that right there? You see that line? I'm going to be the mayor of those kids in a minute. He told me that shit. And I was like, yeah, oh, okay, that's interesting. You know, whatever. And lo and behold, he's the president. You know what I mean? So, yeah, I was like, interesting. But no, he's incredible. I mean, just to have that vision, he totally went against the whole nature of the industry and everything. Did it all his own way, and it's just amazing. Amazing.
That's incredible. Now, it was one of the songs you did with him was Benetton, right,
Benetton.
On your record?
Yeah.
On that record, you talk about how, you know, when you were a kid, I guess right around the time of the first album, you were on tour with Nas and
Fugees.
The Fugees, presumably because you were on the same label at that point. It was a little vague to me on the record, and maybe I misheard it, but it seems like you were saying somehow you didn't take full advantage of that career-wise.
You're fucking good, buddy.
Yeah? What was in the way of that?
Man, everything was in the way of that. Like, my own self, just like, not, like, I don't know, I always had this thing where it's just like, I get all these beautiful blessings and just squander the shit. you know, just fuck it up somehow. Just fuck up, fuck shit up. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. You know, mom sent you to good school, get kicked out. Just fuck it up. Boom, you got a recording deal with Columbia right here. You go on tour with Nas and the Fugees, and go fuck that up. You know what I mean? Like, you know, and I don't, I joke around about it, fuck it up. But really, you know, I look at it like it's like God give me a blessing. But for some reason, it's like I always get these blessings before I get the knowledge to really know how to deal with them. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you live and you learn. I'm still grateful for those things, and they're great experiences. Mm-hmm. But that's what that was. Just, you know, not appreciating it enough. Not really making the most of it. Not being focused. Not being disciplined. Lack of discipline.
What would you have done differently?
I would have, for one, I wouldn't have been getting so twisted. I wouldn't have been drunk and high off my, you know, behind. I'd have been in there like every morning, like 5 minutes early with a cup of coffee. Like today for here.
Right.
I got here like 20 minutes early. Mark that. I've become responsible. Like, you know what I mean? Like, you know, just get there early, you know, do your thing, handle your business. Just give everything the care that it deserves. Mm-hmm. From everything, from the recording process to your relationships, the dealings at the label.
Yeah.
Doing everything appropriate, you know, in the right way. And yeah, you know, so yeah, I wish I could go back and do it again. I really do. I wish I could go back and do it again. Yeah. I still do it now in my own way, but it's not like if Two had that machine,
yeah,
it would have been crazy. It's almost like Two was more geared for that.
Right.
And Constipated Monkey should have been on Amalgam.
Right.
You know what I mean? And that's an interesting part of my life that reoccurs. Mm-hmm. So, you know, life is about not trying not to repeat the same shit. So,
yeah. So what is a constipated monkey exactly?
A constipated monkey. That's funny because the crew growing up around my block was always CM. The CM wasn't about no constipated monkey. It was Criminal Minded, Chainsaw Massacre, again chilling mostly, Cash Money, all that. Mm-hmm. So you put your own twist on it, constipated monkey. Me and Doom are listening to a Last Poets cassette, and the dude saying, when you're sitting at the bar staring into an empty bottle like a constipated monkey, we just fell out like, yo, that was it. CM, constipated monkey, this is funny. So, you know, there it was, constipated monkey. But it's reflective because, yo, for one, look how long it took the shit to drop after that. So that's
pretty right.
Much,
you go.
You know, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Yeah.
And also, too, just like for me to learn shit, like, yo, fucking hard-headed, you know what I mean? Constipated monkey, like, you know. Learn the shit already, like, let it go already. You know,
so what was the I'm sure there were a bunch of reasons, but what were some of the reasons for the delays between the first two records?
That was, some of it was business, like, for one, I didn't like the situation I was in with Pete Nice and him, so it's almost like that put, like, such a black cloud on me moving forward. Plus, Columbia didn't trust the way he was handling the budgets. So they would only give them, like, were willing to give them, like, half the money at a time. And then you got, and then I saw how unlucrative the situation was for me, on top of the fact that I was growing up and seeing new realities. And some of it was partially due to, like, hallucinogenics and shit. Like, I just started hitting a point where it was just, like, I was looking at the whole world differently. Mm-hmm. Due to my growth, due to being super high. You know what I mean? Like, all of that. But it was a good thing, though. It wasn't like a bad, it was a thing where I was like, wait a minute, because I was doing so much shit wrong.
So you actually were doing all the mescaline you talk about on the
hell
first record.
Yeah, hell yeah. Okay. Shrooms, ease. I was, yeah. And these dudes, new kids talk about mollies and all, man, I'm still in that world without doing shit, like, you know, in a good way, though.
Yeah.
But, you know, I learned from a lot of my things. But anyway, point being is that I hit a point where creatively, reality-wise, as a person, I hit a new, like, I couldn't digest all this information. I had to get settled into how I was seeing things. Everything was so messed up in terms of how I was dealing with my situations, mm-hmm. that I had to just sit back and reassess myself and my whole, you know, way that I was just going about stuff. And then at the same time, here I am sitting in this situation that's not a nice business situation, environment. So me, probably in retrospect, I mean, I wouldn't change a thing at that point because I can't force music. And I'm in this new reality, so I have to get settled into it before I can really create from it. So it took me a minute, and then I was in such an uncomfortable way, I just stopped. Like, I'm just like, you know what, fuck this. Almost like, sit out this so I'm not in this contract and in this horrible deal anymore. Mm-hmm. And also in the time, you know, just reassess how I want to do things. Sometimes you need to give yourself a little bit of time. But then what happens is that time turns into a long period of time. So where I'll do a song here, like Grim or Doom could get a verse from me. But they knew I wasn't really recording like that. But they would just be like, George, come on, man. My album's coming out. So only my friend could get me to do a verse.
Right.
I wasn't doing it like on my own, for my own. But I still never quit in my mind. I was never like, I always was like, I got to.
Never like, I'm retired.
No, yeah. Never. I was always like, nah, I got to come back and done. Even if that shit is 50 years later. Like, nah, I'm going to keep making music. But right now is not the time. And days can go by on you, man. You know what I mean? So, you know, I would do a song here, a verse here. But then, you know, meanwhile, I'm having them. Deal with regular life, you know, and earn money and pay bills and, you know, have jobs, lose jobs, hustle, you know, stop hustling and do different stuff, you know, and the days go by and you're just like, y'all want to make this music. I still got to do this. I got this idea for a song, but you just don't do it, right. You know, so that's what took long. But I'm thankful for, like, the people that always try to inspire me creatively because they knew that I really wanted to do it. And to them, they felt like I had talent to do it, so... They always try to encourage me to do it.
Excellent. There was one question I always had about just a name I didn't recognize on the first record.
Yeah.
You shout out Prince Power for putting you up on the bass. I was just wondering who that was.
Prince Power Rule. You never heard of Power Rule?
No,
it's a group.
No.
Oh, my God. They're like one of the first Puerto Rican groups to be signed on a major label.
Okay.
I did my first demos. Well, one of my first demos with him. Some of my first demos. Not the first demo. But, yeah, that's my brother, man, Power Rule. And you can YouTube him, and they had a great... hit at that time called Smooth.
Yeah. Was it important for you to be thought of as like a Latino rapper? I mean, you shout out like...
Yeah, I guess so. You know what? I think people... It wasn't so important to me, but I think I felt not the pressure, but I felt like, you know, not too many Latinos get this opportunity. You better just say it. You know, a lot.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean? Like...
Yeah.
You know, so you got people around you, you know, that want to want you to do that, but... You know, that's the really, man, you know, I mean, I'm proud of I love my culture and all that shit, but, you know, at the end of the day, like, it's bigger than that for me, like.
Yeah. Definitely. When you were not rapping, you have this line about, you know, I was being haunted by my style, and I was just curious what you meant by that. Like, was it like... That you missed rapping, that you heard other people ripping you off?
No.
Like, what was that?
Haunted by my style means that my rhymes was wanting to, like, even if I tried to put it aside, that ghost was always over me, like, this got to come out, buddy. So it's almost like your rhyming ego, like, my own style is haunting me to get out.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? So,
yeah. Excellent. There was one more thing about two that I wanted to talk on, and we can maybe move on to what you're up to now and stuff. There was, on Wake Up, you have that anti-cop verse, and I thought it was great because it's very strong, but it actually talks about the humanity of police officers and their motivations and that they have jobs too, and they're just trying to, you know, do their 20 years and get out or whatever.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about that verse? Like, what made you write it? Why you approached it that way?
God, I mean, really, man, you know, to be honest, like, even at this age, I'm just like, why would I, you know, I don't like the fact that I have such a rebelliousness towards authority and police, you know what I mean? But when you see the stuff that goes on, you can understand it. But it's almost like me trying to exercise some of that to try to come to grips with it within myself, like, so I don't look at these people like they're so horrible, you know? So I'm trying to almost like just be fair about my assessment of the whole police thing. So I had to, by doing that, I had to focus in on the humanity of them. Mm-hmm. And for the fact that I know one cop in my life, and he hurt his leg, so he was retired. And dude is cool. Cool-ass dude. And I can't say the same for 99% of the rest of them. But I know that, you know, some of them it's not like that. But for the other rest of them, I know it's just like a gang member. It's the same mentality, man. It's just, I just don't appreciate the fact that they act like badasses, but they're still protected by the government and they wear a badge. I feel like if you're going to be protected by the government and wear a badge, you should be courteous and respectful at all times. Right. Even if somebody in the street is cursing you out, you fucking pussy, da 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 da, you should still be like, sorry, sir, please tone it down or else we're taking you in. Like, they should always be on that. when they start acting like all that tough guy shit and beating people up, and you know, like that to me is like so cowardly, nauseating that, you know, I guess that part of it gets me so pissed that I had to try to just resolve it within myself. And
that's great. And it, yeah, it was a really great verse. And I thought it did, thank you. Did a lot of that
and,
stuff.
And in times when I've had to deal with policemen, I try to speak to them in that kind of a manner.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. And I thought it was interesting because it was like a fuck the police, but in a man-to-man.
Yeah, like it really was. It didn't back down from criticizing them.
No.
Yeah, yeah.
But, and it's almost also sharing to them why
people
can't stand them. And why, like, I'm thinking this the other day, why don't police ever be, like, in the neighborhoods part of, like, something fun? Like a festival and they're giving out food to kids or candy or toys and be out there socializing with the people and smiling and, you know, like, they never do stuff like that. It's always, like, on bad terms. Like, I don't know, do they feel like we're going to lose respect for them if they come do that? I feel like that would make things so much better, like, if they really come out and try to get to know the people. Hey, Mr. Johnson. Hi, officer. Whatever. You know what I mean? Like, just really interact with us and do that. And it would take a lot of the edge off of the situation. But it seems like you never see that.
Yeah, definitely. You know? No. I know that you know, Wikipedia is definitely not the most reliable of sources. Uh-huh. But when I was, you know, doing research for this and looking at that, it mentioned something about you working with teen MCs. Is that true?
I did an after-school program at Westside High on 102nd in Amsterdam. Mm-hmm. It's a high school, and it's an alternative high school. Like, I guess kids that get sent out of other schools, they come there. Mm-hmm. And growing up around my way, it's right in the middle of Douglas Project. Growing up around my way, that school was wild. And it's still, you know, but now they've redone it. And it's a great facility, but it was always like the nuttiest school, you know what I mean? But, you know, it was just ironic that I happened to work there because it's not like I got an inside hookup. It's like, yo, I just sent out my thing on the computer. And it just so happens, I mean, my mom grew up, I grew up right there, you know what I mean? So it's like, and I get this job there and I'm doing this after school, this great after school program with the other teachers, Albert Bouchard from Blue Oyster Cult. He's a rock and roll drummer.
Yeah,
cool dude, you know. So they got me there, and here we go with these kids, you know, doing hip hop after school program. I'm loving it, you know. It was just amazing, and I did it for 2 years. I don't know if this year they're gonna have enough money to bring me back.
Yeah,
you know, because, you know, funds are whatever. But yeah, great experience. Anything you want to know about that? Just
yeah, yeah, that's incredible.
As a matter of fact, I spoke to one of my kids. I mean, there's some real talent. I mean, talent. Like, I'm gonna get some of these kids on my new record. The first year was mostly all hip hop and recording and, you know, Garage Band and Reason and all that stuff, Logic. And then the second year, these kids, I really didn't have as much of an influential part other than supporting them, you know, emotionally. Mm-hmm. And there, and telling them about the business, and I have an ear for music, but these dudes play instruments and read music, which I don't do.
Right.
So I was really just sitting back, getting a check, and just in awe, just watching these great, talented kids every day, or, you know, not every day, but a few times a week. So it turned into the second year, most of them were live instrumentalists. So you're seeing, like, a lot of the urban kids now, they're straight up playing punk rock, some of them. It's great, you know what I mean? You're seeing the kids exposed to so much different stuff. For me, you know, I'm kind of biased. I had more fun the first year.
Sure.
It was more the pure hip-hop. Yeah. But this was incredible, and it's just amazing where the kids are taking it now. You know, people knock it a lot in the hip-hop, and I don't knock the musicianship. I knock more like what the radio chooses to play all the time and over again.
Sure.
But in terms of where the kids are going with it, it's really an interesting place. You know, some of their clothing styles I can figure out. You know what I mean? But the rest of it is all right, you know. Yeah.
Definitely. Yep. So tell me a little bit about the third record. What's going on with it now?
Yo, man, I think, man, it's going to be, it's just fun, man. I got, I wish I had, well, I do. I have some of it in my car so you could get a listen to it. But it's just a real fun record, and it's got a lot of, like, that disco fun element, a lot of that 80s. Nice. Element, and I'm gonna go even further into that because I'm about to do a disco, dusty ass disco record, the whole shit.
Nice.
You know, but that's like the way my shit is going right now. Like, I'm just really gonna bug out with that sound and that kind of fun stuff, and still there's a lot of ingredients in there. You know, I got my my conscious self. I got my ignorant self. I got my little chip on my shoulder towards the game self, like kind of sarcastic, but it doesn't never hate, like sound angry or nothing like that.
Yeah.
You know, and I just kind of mix it up into all that, but all with a nice, moving, groovy, musical setting.
Awesome.
You know.
And what's the status of the Bamboo Brothers? The Bamboo Brothers,
that album is out. It's called American Hibato. That's a wonderful chamber. Shout out to my man, Dave Dar. Right. Oh, that's what I wish. Can we get on the podcast? Can we put the Twitter and all that stuff?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. You know, we'll shout it out now. Everyone will hear it.
Yeah, follow me on the Twitter, Official Curious. And on Facebook, Curious George. Curious with a K, George with a J. Or you can go to my fan page, where you really need to go there because the other one's filled up. Official Curious also on the Facebook. All one word, Official Curious, Curious with a K.
All right. And any idea when we can might be able to see the completed third album?
The third album? Yeah. I'm looking at it, you know, man, like the beginning of 2013.
Okay. Yeah. Awesome. So outside the lens with Rap Genius. Curious, thanks for coming
by. I just got to say, man, this is no bullshit. Rap Genius, you guys are really that, man. And I just appreciate the way you go and find lines and really come with relevant questions and spark good conversation, because I get a lot of the same old type of stuff, and it was really cool.
Thank you.
My man.
All right.
Thank you, man.
All right.
You've been listening to Outside the Lines with Rap Genius. If you're curious about any of the songs mentioned on this show, you can find lyrics, audio, and explanations at rapgenius.com. Rap Genius is dedicated to decoding, annotating, and analyzing hip-hop lyrics. Join us next week when we talk to academic Trisha Rose about her seminal books Black Noise and the Hip-Hop Wars, The State of Rap Today, and lots more. Outside the Lines with Rap Genius is hosted and written by Sean Sitaro, a.k.a. Same Old Sean. To make sure you never miss an episode of the show, please subscribe to this podcast via iTunes. You can reach me with your thoughts about Outside the Lines on Twitter. I'm at Same Old Sean. That's S-H-A-W-N. This podcast was recorded and engineered by Brian Penny at the beautiful 3Egg Studios in Brooklyn, New York. Our camera work was handled by Dan Berger, and our show's intern is Sunny Kahara. Intro and outro music by Psionic, interlude music by Sir Loin. I'm your host, Same Old Sean, and I'll see you next week on Outside the Lines with Rap Genius.